The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Located a little less than 30 miles north of the state capital, Georgetown, Texas was founded in 1848. Though the area was already home to a village of Tonkawa Native Americans, the city only began its journey to becoming what it is today when its namesake, Kentucky native George Washington Glasscock, donated 172 acres of land while helping create and organize Williamson County. Williamson County, by the way, was named after Robert McAlpin Williamson, also known as Three-Legged Willie. Williamson was named such because at age 15, he was stricken with the white swelling, or tubercular arthritis, leaving him with the right leg paralyzed from the knee down, the leg permanently stiffened at a 90-degree angle. From then on out, he used a wooden leg which attached at the knee. The paralyzed portion of his leg remained and protruded behind him. But it wasn't the cool nickname that earned him a namesake county. Later on in life, Williamson became known for his adept understanding of the law. He was a private practice attorney, a San Felipe district prosecutor, a newspaper editor and publisher, and even a part of the delegation responsible for the provisional Texas government just before the state gained its independence. A master marksman and proficient horseman, Williamson was made major of the Texas Rangers, was shortly thereafter named a judge, and went on to serve in Texas's Congress. Georgetown was created to be the county seat of Williamson County, and the city's proximity to Austin made it a desirable destination for settlers. So too did the clear waters of the San Gabriel River, the abundance of good timber, and perhaps the hardest thing to resist, the inexpensive but extremely fertile land. Trailing closely behind the establishment of Southwestern University came the completion of railroad construction through Georgetown in 1878. By 1890, Swedish, German, Austrian, and Czech immigrants had all flocked to the area, following the first wave of settlers that had come from the eastern and midwestern United States mostly. Upon the cusp of the 20th century, Georgetown's economy had grown diverse and incredibly strong, due in large part, no doubt, to the differing talents and trades each immigrant group brought to the community. Cotton production was king, but other agriculture, a brick factory, confectionaries, lumber yards, bakeries, ranching, and limestone quarries were all businesses that promised Georgetown a bright future. Though a flood had devastated many area crops, businesses, and residences in 1921, it wasn't until the completion of a dam at the San Gabriel River in 1979 that the city leaders finally solved Georgetown's flooding issues. Completion of that dam, along with a few other necessary steps, resulted in the formation of Lake Georgetown. As 20th century technological advances demanded, the city saw additional industrial development in the form of manufacturing, an expansion of local government services, and a still incredibly diverse service industry. The population of Georgetown, however, only modestly grew with the passing of every decade's census information collection until 1980. When the city saw an increase of 48%, its biggest in 100 years. The following decade saw an almost 57% increase in population, and the year 2000, with an increase of 91%, was Georgetown's largest since the flood of European immigrants came in 1880. In less than 30 years, the small Texas city had gone from around 6,000 residents to nearly 30,000. The growth is certainly substantial, but it hardly put Georgetown among the state's big cities, like Houston, San Antonio, and Dallas. Generally, when a city or an area sees as dramatic growth as Georgetown did at the turn of the 21st century, a markedly clear rise in the crime rate can be seen right along with the rise in population. The crime rate, the number of crimes per 100,000 people, that is, doesn't just grow alongside the population, remaining virtually the same. Rather, the statistical percentage usually becomes a larger number. While this happened to a point in Georgetown, the overall crime rate there was about half of the national average in the early 2000s. As for violent crimes, rapes and murders specifically, they too sat, and continue to sit, well below the national average. Just like anywhere else, a vast majority of missing persons in Georgetown, Texas, are found relatively quickly. But at the time of this recording, and from what I can tell, there are currently 9 individuals missing from Williamson County, or more accurately, perhaps at least 9 who have been reported missing. One of those people who vanished in 1991, Vicki Nisbet, remains missing even after her estranged husband, Rex Nisbet, was convicted of killing her. The cops seem to have known what happened to Vicki from the get-go, and only needed technology to catch up so they could prove it. The case of another Williamson County missing person, however, isn't nearly as clear-cut. Even with several events thought to be major breaks in the case, a ton of media coverage, and scandals within the investigating agency, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office, the disappearance of 19-year-old Rachel Cook remains as mysterious, perhaps, as the day it occurred. Rachel Louise Cook was born in Dallas, Texas on May 10, 1982, to parents Janet and Robert. Working as an advisory software engineer at IBM, Robert Cook was transferred to the Austin area in 1984, shortly before the birth of Rachel's little sister, Joanne. Just 2 years later, in 1986, the Cook family finally settled into a longer-term arrangement in Williamson County, at the North Lake subdivision, just northwest of the county seat, Georgetown. Development of the North Lake subdivision began in the late 1970s. The idea was to build a tranquil, relatively private subdivision just minutes from the lake. The homes in the neighborhood were spaced far apart with expansive driveways, most with thickets of well-established pecan, cottonwood, elm, and live oak trees in the large side yards separating residences. The subdivision was ideal for folks seeking some peace and quiet, while still within a reasonable distance of the conveniences the nearby small city offered, including easy and fast access to restaurants, stores, and schools. The Cooks certainly thought it was ideal, and they considered their new home and neighborhood the perfect place to bring up their 2 girls. The house, located on the 200 block of Navajo Trail, was something of a dream home for the young family, since Janet and Robert had it designed and built to their specifications, and it sat on nearly 3 acres, with a large ranch directly behind the property, allowing for even more privacy. Janet even built the short rustic fence that runs along the road herself out of thick tree branches. But it wasn't just the house. This particular piece of the North Lake subdivision had no through roads, several dead-end streets, and only 3 ways in. The only traffic coming through the area was residents. If you didn't live there or you weren't providing some type of service for those residents, you didn't have any business being on these roads. Shortly after their arrival in Williamson County, Janet picked up a job teaching visual arts at Georgetown Independent School District. and Robert continued to commute to his job in North Austin at IBM, about 30 miles south of home. Once the Cooks were established in Northlake, the house quickly became the designated spot for family get-togethers. The close proximity to Lake Georgetown, the long porch and big yard, and the remarkably low crime rate made it the perfect place to celebrate holidays with relatives. This was great for Robert and Janet, of course, but perhaps even better for the kids. Rachel and her little sister Joanne grew up in a loving, stable environment, and as they got older, it showed. Rachel was innocent, sweet, and embraced life as both a little girl and as she navigated her way through late childhood and adolescence. She was a kind and loyal friend who was always there for someone in need. Her infectious humor and genuine concern could make anyone feel better, and she sought out people who the other kids ignored or shunned. Rachel was obsessed with fashion, as could easily be seen by her wardrobe and her hairstyles, but it was animals, any kind of animal, that had her heart. So much so that she became a vegetarian. All of these things, and Rachel's extremely outgoing personality, made her popular among her peers. It didn't hurt that she was an accomplished runner who was on the all-star track and cross-country teams at Georgetown High and sang in the school's choir. Throughout most of her teenage years, Rachel dated a boy named Thomas. Rachel Cook was always something of a daredevil, as her father once put it. She liked things like roller coasters and never shied away from a good thrill. So, after graduating from Georgetown High School in 2000, it was only natural and totally expected that Rachel take a big chance on her future by moving to California to attend college. It seems like I can't get a minute to myself these days. The podcast, the dreaded day job, and family responsibilities make sure of that. But the few instances I am able to take a breath and unwind, I make the most of it by playing a few levels of Best Fiends. Best Fiends is the only Match 3 style puzzle game for me, and there are plenty of reasons for that. I absolutely love the little bugs and other small creatures that make up my slug-busting army, and I totally dig the game's bright colors and dramatic flair when blowing stuff up. But it is undoubtedly the differing strategies each and every level demands that keeps me coming back and keeps my brain engaged while simultaneously relieving the stress of, well, everything else everywhere. I'm on level 5629 as I speak, and since new levels are added all the time, I never run out. You'll never get bored playing Best Fiends. Trust me on that, and the more you win, the more challenges there are for you to face. So take a little time for yourself and download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Janet Cook once spoke of her daughter excitedly digging through the sand to find and collect seashells as a toddler on a family trip to the ocean. Rachel loved the beach, her mother recalled, and one friend commented that she was more than a dreamer, she was a doer. So, it was perhaps no surprise when Rachel moved to San Diego, California to attend Mesa Junior College. It was way back in junior high, her friend remembered, that Rachel first began talking about living in California. She was born and raised in Texas, sure, but Rachel Cook was always drawn to the Golden State. California's beaches, fashion, music, and more vegetarian-accessible cuisine were a little more up her alley than Texas's cowboy boots and steakhouses. Not long after moving to San Diego, Rachel met a boy named Greg West, and the two began a whirlwind romance. Greg had never been in love, judging by comments he later made. He recalled when he met Rachel, he knew this was it, the real thing, and he could tell by, quote, the butterflies. Greg West thought Rachel Cook was amazing. The two could be themselves around each other, he said. According to her sister Joanne, Rachel was also happy and felt like Greg was the one. And in fact, the two planned to move in together after dating for a while and had even discussed getting engaged. Presumably, they planned to move in together in Los Angeles, since that's where Rachel intended to transfer colleges in pursuit of her dream to study fashion design. When classes let out for the 2001 winter break at Mesa Junior College, Rachel Cook invited her boyfriend, Greg West, to travel with her to Williamson County, Texas. Greg, of course, was more than happy to accompany his first true love home for the holidays. They arrived in Texas on December 21, 2001. The fact that Rachel's family thought Greg was a pretty great guy and more or less stamped their seal of approval on him almost definitely rendered Rachel even more smitten than she already was. Unfortunately, Greg couldn't stay the entirety of winter break in Texas with Rachel, since he had to get back to San Diego for work. He headed back to California on New Year's Day, 2002. After Greg left, Rachel missed her boyfriend and grew bored at home alone every day while everyone else was at school or work. But she was happy to be visiting her parents and the home she'd grown up in. She was comfortable and fell into a routine not unlike the one she had followed before moving to California. Mostly, Rachel kept herself busy by running in 4-mile stretches, presumably making laps around the North Lake neighborhood, calling her dad at work once or twice a day, and by catching up and hanging out with friends when they were able. As Sunday, January 13, 2002 drew nearer, the day Rachel Cook was supposed to catch a plane back to San Diego, she was trying to keep herself busy. She planned to attend her cousin's wedding in Marble Falls the Saturday before and continued to do her daily runs. On Thursday, January 10, 2002, Robert Cook left for work early since his commute took him all the way down to North Austin. As Janet and Joanne left the house at around 8 a.m., Joanne to attend classes at Georgetown High School and Janet to teach art class there, she approached Rachel, who was sound asleep on the living room couch. Joanne tried her best to stop her mom from bothering her big sis by telling her not to wake Rachel up, but it was no use. Janet gave Rachel several kisses and said, "I love you," to which Rachel replied in grumbles that translated to, "Leave me alone, Mom." Janet left for work, taking Joanne with her for school. Rachel woke up not long after everyone was gone. Like every college student, she relished sleep, particularly on long breaks. But Rachel also liked to keep busy and needed every possible hour in the day to take care of the things she wanted to do. Between 9 and 9:15 that morning, Rachel Cook spoke with her boyfriend Greg West on the phone. He, of course, was back in San Diego. It was the usual daily chat, both Rachel and Greg checking up on one another and joking around back and forth. Everything was completely normal. Rachel was happy and herself on the call. There were no signs of trouble whatsoever. Greg asked Rachel if she'd been on her morning run yet. She hadn't and told Greg she was going to go ahead and go. After asking her to call him when her run was over, Greg and Rachel hung up. She never called him back. Because Rachel was to attend her cousin's wedding the following Saturday, her father, Robert Cook, took off work a little early to take his daughter shopping for something to wear. He also planned to stay home the next day so he could spend some time with Rachel. When he arrived at home at 4:45 p.m., Robert was surprised to see the garage door open. No cars were inside, so he figured Janet had come home, dropped off Joanne, and headed to the theater where she acted in plays for rehearsal. But when he got inside, Robert discovered that neither Joanne nor Rachel was there to meet him. The house was completely empty and quiet, and it looked like no one had been there for a while. Robert saw that his daughter's purse was left behind, and worry began to set in. Inside the purse was Rachel's wallet, and inside that, her driver's license and cash. She would have never purposefully left without those items or her cell phone, which was also there. Perhaps, he thought, Rachel had taken a late afternoon jog, and he'd simply missed seeing her as he drove through North Lake on his way home. But as his mind began to wander, Robert Cook realized that his daughter hadn't called him all day, and that was certainly unusual. Rachel always found or made up some excuse to call her father. Still, for some, imagining something terrible has happened to their child is a place their minds will fight going as long as possible. Robert also thought Rachel's longtime best friend Shannon had come by to pick her up early, since the two had plans to hang out that night. Janet and Joanne got back home at 5 p.m. driving her pickup, after dropping off the rental car Janet had been using while the truck was in the shop. Robert decided to call Shannon. The father was troubled to learn that Shannon had not seen nor spoken with Rachel. Robert and Janet's minds were still refusing to acknowledge the worst possible scenarios. Janet phoned the upscale, historic downtown Georgetown restaurant Wildfire, where Rachel sometimes worked to pick up some extra pocket cash. Perhaps, the parents thought, the restaurant had called her in, and she had left behind her purse and cell phone on accident, as she was in a hurry to get out the door. When Janet asked if Rachel was there, the person who picked up the phone at Wildfire told the worried mother that yes, she had worked a shift that evening, but left about an hour earlier. Both Robert and Janet Cook breathed a sigh of relief at that news. The whole thing had been a mix-up, and Rachel simply failed to communicate what was going on. Only, that's not what happened at all. On Friday, January 11th, 2002, Robert and Janet Cook awoke to find their daughter, 19-year-old Rachel Louise Cook, still hadn't made it home. Janet took their other daughter, Joanne, to school and decided to try and work herself, but after a few calls to Robert and no word from Rachel, she headed home. Worry had set back in big time, and Janet stopped by Wildfire on her way home to clarify that Rachel had been there the night before. Someone there began phoning the night shift until they found out A, Rachel had indeed worked a shift the past evening, but a different Rachel, not Rachel Cook. Something her parents now knew was terribly wrong. Robert scrambled to comb through his daughter's belongings to see if there were clues as to where she may have gone. He learned that the only items of Rachel's that appeared to be missing were a pair of her running shoes and running clothes. The parents were horrified. It meant Rachel went out for her morning run and never came back. It meant, in no uncertain terms, that something unthinkable had happened to her. Their first thought was that someone had accidentally hit Rachel with their vehicle while she was out for her morning run. So Janet stopped by the hospital to see if a Rachel Cook or any unidentified woman had been admitted since the previous day. None had. No Rachel Cook. No Jane Doe's. Meanwhile, Robert drove his daughter's running route slowly, carefully checking the roadsides for Rachel in case she'd been hit by a car and thrust into the median as a result. But he found nothing, not even a sign of his daughter. It had been well over 24 hours since anyone had heard from Rachel Cook. At 2 p.m. on Friday, January 11th, 2002, Robert and Janet Cook met at the Williamson County Sheriff's Office. The parents, of course, were a mess. Explaining to a deputy the circumstances of their daughter's disappearance was not easy, especially since the deputy's present thought the couple was overreacting Georgetown, as well as Williamson County on the outskirts of the city, were extremely low-crime areas. Violent crime, and especially things like kidnapping or murder, were virtually unheard of there. It's often reported, something that is not necessarily true. They were told to fill out a missing persons report. They did, and the report was filed. As in most cases of missing young adults, Rachel's disappearance was considered by authorities at first to be a lapse in responsible judgment and lack of communication. She'd be back, they told the worried parents. Don't worry about it. Instead of listening to the concerns of Robert and Janet Cook, who knew their daughter better than anyone, deputies placed Rachel Cook into a generalized idea, an almost cartoonish idea, of what young adults are, what behavior they display. To say the least, the parents of the missing young woman were frustrated with their visit to the sheriff's office. Rachel never stayed away without letting them know what was going on. She never left her stuff behind. And anyway, it wasn't only that she hadn't called them that had Janet and Robert so worried. Not only was she supposed to have hung out with her best friend the night before, but she also never called to cancel, something that was absolutely not like her. Rachel had failed to call Greg West back, her boyfriend in San Diego. That, too, was highly unusual. A deputy at the sheriff's office told Janet and Robert that an investigator would be in touch, but they never called that afternoon or evening. Robert and Janet Cook knew the clock was ticking. They decided that if the Williamson County Sheriff's Office wasn't going to help, they'd organize search parties themselves and begin an investigation on their own. By that evening, the Cooks had informed everyone who knew Rachel that she was missing, and they all wanted to help however they could. The owner of Wildfire came to the house. He and Janet began searching while Robert waited in vain by the phone for the sheriff's office to call. Greg West called, wondering where his girlfriend was, why she hadn't called him back. Robert told him that his daughter was missing. Early the next day, Saturday, January 12, 2002, Robert and Janet called the Williamson County Sheriff's Office. Why, they asked, hadn't an investigator yet called? A deputy assured the panicked parents that one would, soon. Around 50 people showed up at the Cook home that morning, including many of Robert's family members from Marble Falls and Austin. Everyone was there to help search for Rachel Cook. They began, of course, near her home in the Northlake subdivision. Robert and his mother began making missing persons flyers. Besides her close friends and family, several neighbors on horseback joined the search efforts, allowing the group to cover far more area, not to mention the rough and rugged terrain that would be difficult and time-consuming without them. At about 10:45 a.m., a captain at the sheriff's office called and told Robert that an investigator and deputy were on their way out. The deputy showed up at around 11:30 a.m. and took a written report as he looked through Rachel's cell phone, logging her last calls. Robert had, of course, already done this. The deputy assured the missing young woman's father that any minute now, Rachel would walk through the door or call them from somewhere and tell them that she'd run off with a new boyfriend. Robert couldn't understand this. She'd left everything behind, he told the apathetic policeman, her phone, her purse, her money, her ID. The deputy just looked at Robert Cook with glazed over eyes. By noon, after the deputy had finished speaking with Robert and taking his report, he told the father to call off the searches. The department was going to bring in tracking dogs, and trampling through the brush and tall grass would affect the canine unit's ability to properly do their job. The folks on horseback could continue, the deputy said, since that doesn't leave a scent that will throw off the dogs. When the canines arrived, they were brought into the Cook home to pick up on Rachel's scent. By 3 p.m. that day, the searchers were allowed to continue. Williamson County Sheriff's Office deputies split the 100 or so policemen and civilian volunteers into groups and sent them off in different directions. The Cook home became a sort of command station at this point. Sheriff John Maspero came. The media was notified and would be spreading the word via newspaper and television too, the Cooks were told. Both Robert and Janet were questioned and told everything they knew about Rachel's life, her last movements as they were aware, and her habits and routines. Ultimately, the day's searches and police investigation led to nothing. The day ended with no trace of Rachel Cook or any clues pointing to what happened to her. Everyone went home, and that night in Marble Falls, Texas, Rachel's cousin's wedding took place as it was scheduled, but everyone present was fully aware that she was missing. This made the occasion far less joyous and, perhaps, left all in attendance with a feeling of emptiness. A prayer was spoken for Rachel at the end of the ceremony. As this day ended, it's unclear if the Williamson County Sheriff's Office still believed Rachel had simply run off. But for whatever reason, they took little action that afternoon and evening, and by the time they did, more than 72 hours had passed since Rachel was last heard from. On Sunday, January 13th, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office phoned the Texas Rangers, asking for their assistance in Rachel Cook's disappearance. Though Sheriff John Maspero had reportedly forbade his deputies and investigators from doing so, Rangers wasted no time grilling the Cook family. Between those interviews and interviews with friends, Texas Ranger Matt Lindemann quickly determined that Rachel had not left of her own free will at all. Her disappearance, he easily ascertained, was incredibly suspicious and most likely involved foul play. This is a markedly different notion than the one the Williamson County Sheriff's Department initially had, which was a sort of blind optimism that Rachel was just going to turn up at some point, reappearing, perhaps, out of the same thin air in which she'd vanished. Robert Cook still felt at this point that the Williamson County Sheriff's Office continued to believe that Rachel left of her own free will. Rachel's boyfriend, Greg West, flew in this day as well, having booked a flight the minute he found out his sweetheart had vanished. While it was confirmed easily and quickly that Greg was in San Diego when Rachel Cook disappeared, Williamson County Sheriff's Office investigators still deemed it necessary to spend time and resources questioning and polygraphing him all but immediately upon his arrival in Texas. For 3 hours, detectives questioned Greg. He was eliminated as a suspect in his girlfriend's disappearance, of course. Both Robert and Janet Cook were racking their brains, theorizing scenarios. Robert told the cops that they rarely locked their doors, and perhaps whoever was responsible snuck into the house, lied in wait until Rachel returned from her morning run, and then attacked. That also seemed likely because when he got home Thursday, the garage door was wide open. Detectives agreed this was plausible and searched the Cook home for any evidence that an abduction had taken place there. No sign substantiating this theory was found, but it still seems incredibly plausible. Police wrapped the perimeter of the house with yellow tape, and only law enforcement was allowed in. Robert, Janet, and Joanne were even given only limited access to the house. The Cooks signed consent forms for sheriff's office investigators to search their vehicles. It was confusing to them to be treated like suspects when both of them were at work with dozens of co-workers who could vouch for them. But it didn't deter Robert and Janet. They continued to perform their own investigation, independent of the police. Texas Rangers and Williamson County deputies spent the better part of Sunday the 13th attempting to account for Rachel's every movement in the hours before she went missing. She spoke with her boyfriend Greg between 9 and 9:15 a.m. on Thursday, January 10, 2002. It's known Rachel was wearing her usual workout clothes, Asics running shoes, a lime green sports bra, gray shorts, and a yellow Walkman with sports-style headphones when she left for her run at approximately 9:30. A Walkman, for those of y'all who might be too young to recall, is a portable cassette player slash radio. iPods, for reference here, had only been out for a little over 2 months when Rachel disappeared. Although the morning is often referred to as a chilly one in news reports, it wasn't at all. In fact, it was 73 degrees at 9:30 a.m. that day when Rachel is thought to have begun her run, so her long-sleeved sweatshirt was tied around her waist. Rachel was a creature of habit and always followed the same running route. This route has been reported as both 4 miles and 6 miles, so presumably on the day she felt up to it, Rachel ran longer than usual. Authorities were able to find 6 witnesses in the Northlake neighborhood who saw Rachel on her run the day she vanished. Every witness saw the missing young woman on what would have been her usual running route. The Cooks were longtime residents of the Northlake subdivision. In fact, Rachel was only 4 years old when they moved there, so most of the witnesses weren't simply thinking they might have seen her. They knew her well and were positive. When Rachel began her run, she began east on Navajo Trail. Not far from her house in that direction was a new home being constructed, where a man spreading dirt saw Rachel run by. An elderly couple who lived next door to the Cooks saw and waved to Rachel as they were out on a walk. Another Northlake resident saw Rachel near her home, which was located at the end of one of the cul-de-sacs there, suggesting that her route included circling the long dead-end streets as well. Rachel had stopped to stretch there, and she and the witness exchanged waves and smiles. About 100 yards from the home, between 10:30 and 11 a.m., a neighbor saw Rachel walking on Natchez Trail, presumably ending her run with a cool down and preparing to go back home. At around 11 a.m. at the corner of Natchez and Navajo Trails, another neighbor saw Rachel walking toward her home as he backed his car out of his driveway. This would be approximately 250 feet from the Cook's house. He was the last known person to see 19-year-old Rachel Cook alive. Witnesses were able to provide detectives with a rough timeline. The most likely time Rachel met with foul play was in the neighborhood of 11 a.m., and it was somewhere near her home, if not on her home's property. Early that day, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office had organized a large-scale search. Deputies split civilian volunteers into search parties to scour the immediate area around the Cook home and along Rachel's known running route. Volunteers included about 50 of Robert Cook's IBM co-workers, and approximately 150 civilians in total showed up. A busload of students showed up from Georgetown High, where Rachel graduated, and were charged with passing out water to searchers. A helicopter was deployed too, providing the advantage of both an aerial view and the ability to cover more ground faster. Though that vantage point certainly had one major disadvantage, much of the terrain was covered by wooded areas. On foot, horseback, and all-terrain vehicles, and using tracking dogs, they searched for hours, covering around 50 square miles, but ultimately they turned up nothing at all. No signs that Rachel Cook had been hit by a car, and no signs anywhere that a struggle had taken place. On Monday, January 14, 2002, almost 96 hours after Rachel Cook vanished. Search parties gathered at a Lake Georgetown park. They searched all day. One of the searchers fell from a cliff near the lake and was airlifted to the hospital. The Cooks received food from friends, neighbors, and coworkers. So much, in fact, that they had to give a lot away. They brought in deputies who'd been searching into their home to feed them as well. When Janet and Robert found out that an Austin Police Department dog handler and a Williamson County Sheriff's Office dog handler hadn't eaten all day, they insisted they come in and grab a bite. While they ate, they told Rachel's parents that the dogs had picked up her scent at the corner of Navajo Trail, and that scent led to a man-made pond on a nearby property. A diver would have to be called in to search the small body of water. As Williamson County Sheriff's Office detectives continued visiting and interviewing neighbors of the Cooks, they discovered sightings of strangers in the neighborhood. Again, where the Cooks lived, the North Lake subdivision, there were no through roads. It was a big rectangle. The Cooks' home was at the very top street, the northernmost street, Navajo Trail. On each end of Navajo Trail, to the east and west, are Council Road and Natchez Trail, respectively. These two streets led out on the main road, FM 3405, or North Lake Road, to the south, as does Wichita Trail, which runs parallel to them, but ends two house lots before Navajo Trail, never reaching it. Now, there was at least one house under construction at the time, but even still, it was unusual for residents to see folks in the neighborhood that they didn't recognize. But several said they did the day Rachel disappeared. Witnesses reported seeing a white or blue late model vehicle, either a Chevy Camaro or Pontiac Trans Am, with white or black racing stripes across the hood and trunk. Those are very conflicting descriptions, I know. Don't worry, it gets a lot more confusing than that. In the car, these witnesses told detectives, were two males, both appearing to be in their late teens or early 20s. Some witnesses reported three people in the car. The person driving was described as dark-complexioned, possibly Hispanic, with slicked-back black hair. He was reported by at least one of the witnesses as talking to a female jogger on FM 3405 or North Lake Road. The Williamson County Sheriff's Office was no closer to finding 19-year-old Rachel Cook at this point than they were while they were sitting on their hands, insisting she'd just run off to party. But as the case grew colder, it simultaneously grew more convoluted and confusing. And perhaps the most likely scenario, the simplest theory to come to in this case, became buried beneath the muck and the mire. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about the disappearance of Rachel Louise Cook, please contact the Williamson County Sheriff's Office at 512-948-2911. Or their cold case tip line at 512-943-5204. The Austin American Statesman, the Austin Daily Texan, KXAN.com, KVUE.com, Fox7Austin.com, and the Journal of Robert Cook were used as sources for this episode. You can support the show at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There, you can get the show ad-free and enjoy Patreon-exclusive episodes that tell stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. I get those out as much as I can, which is not as often as I would like. We also donate some proceeds to DNASolves.com and the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group. Speaking of those two great causes, you can help solve cold cases and help identify Jane and John Doe's by supporting one of the many crowdfunding efforts at DNASolves.com, and you can upload your DNA data to the database there. It's only used for law enforcement investigations. DNA Solves is Othram Incorporated, the folks who solved the Carla Walker case alongside the Fort Worth Police Department. If you want to help the Fort Worth Police solve a cold case, you can donate directly to them at fwpdcoldcasesupport.org. We'll provide a link to both DNA Solves and the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Support Group in the episode's show notes. Another way you can support Gone Cold is by leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes or wherever else you listen. Those reviews help Gone Cold's visibility, which helps new listeners find us, which increases the potential for someone with information hearing the show and reporting what they know to authorities. We appreciate more than words can express any support you give Gone Cold, DNASolves.com, the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Support Group, or any other folks whose cause is to provide long overdue justice to victims or the families of victims. So thank you in advance. Thanks for listening, y'all.